handling of the nuclear power plant crippled by last year's earthquake and tsunami. Investigators say TEPCO continues to underestimate the scope of damage done to the Fukushima Daiichi plant 16 months after the disaster. The report also says TEPCO is dragging its feet in multiple investigations. Some tense moments last night on a freeway in Southern California. The pilot of a Cessna with four people aboard made an emergency landing on Interstate 15 in Escondido. Authorities say there was light traffic on the freeway at the time, and then that pilot was able to avoid hitting any vehicles. That happened about 30 miles north of San Diego. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, who values straightforward reporting and straightforward banking. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Jim Rue at Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties on many products. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959. 367-8121.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
On Valentine's Day 2008, Stephen Kazmierczak killed five students and wounded 18 others on the campus of Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. He then killed himself. And when this happened, people asked the question that they always asked: how did this happen? Why did this happen? The person in question, Steve Kazmierczak, had been an A student. He was a Dean's Award winner, and some people looked at that and said this would not be the kind of person they would expect would commit an act like this. But the truth is that Steve Kazmierczak had a very dark past, something that a lot of the people he knew and his teachers at Northern did not know about. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with David Vann. This is something that he writes about in his recent book. It's titled Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter, and it's published by the University of Georgia Press. He had access to the police files in this case and was able to look at material that a lot of other people didn't see. And in this book, he presents what is probably one of the most complete, rounded portraits we have of any school shooter. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him on the show. Just a little bit more about him. His first book, Legend of a Suicide, has won many prizes. It's been translated into 18 languages. He's the author of the best-selling memoir, A Mile Down, The True Story of a Disastrous Career at Sea, and he's also written for a wide range of publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, Esquire, Outside, Men's Health, The Sunday Times, The Guardian, Financial Times, others, too many to mention. He's joining us this morning by phone. And David Vann, hello.
Hi.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm good. Thanks. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Maybe
it would be best to start for people who either didn't follow these events as we did here because there was a connection, or perhaps people who have forgotten. Just give us the thumbnail of what happened on that day, Valentine's Day 2008, there in DeKalb.
Well, Steve Kazmierczak had been planning it for at least 11 days in advance, and he stayed in a hotel in town, and then he drove to campus, and he waited outside a classroom, and I think almost didn't go in, almost decided not to do it, but came in at the end of a class in an auditorium, and came in the back door of it onto the stage and shot a shotgun with six shots and then a pistol with 48 shots, I think it was, and ended up killing five students and himself and wounding 18. It happened very quickly. It happened in about 3 minutes or so. And then afterward, of course, there was a very long aftermath, a large community affected by what had happened. And this was, of course, the end of a very long history for Steve, and that's what the book focuses on, is the portrait of him all the way from childhood up until this moment to try to understand who he was and how he could have done this.
And this was, I think, the important thing here is that if you do have the benefit of that long view, that this sort of some of the initial superficial details that came out about him, the fact that there at Northern he seemed to be doing okay, at least he was a good student, and at that point, right when this happened, people looked at him and said, well, why would this person do this? If you have the longer view, it becomes at least more understandable that he might do this.
Yeah, he had reinvented himself over the past 5 years before the shooting. And so for all of his teachers and fellow graduate students at NIU, what he did didn't make any sense. They couldn't match up the Steve they knew with this killer. At the time of the shooting, he was actually a student at University of Illinois, where you are. Mm-hmm. He had transferred, switched to a different graduate program, and he went back to the place where he had succeeded and where he had all the connections to teachers and students and everything to do his shooting. So if you had only known him during that 5 years, none of it would make any sense. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until I went back to his junior high and high school friends and interviewed them and then was able to gain access to all the files on him, the 1,500 pages of files. It wasn't until then that I was able to see a life that made sense for someone who had become a shooter. And earlier on, he had every warning sign you could possibly have.
Yeah. There's so much here that we could talk about. I guess one of the things that I'm interested, though, is how it is that you came to the story. And I think it's not so much a story that you sought out, but it's a story that found you.
Yeah, I wanted to write about how armed suburban youth are. When my father killed himself with a gun, with a pistol, when I was 13 years old, my family thought it would be a great idea to give me all of his guns afterward. So I was 13 years old, my dad had just committed suicide, and I had his 300 Magnum rifle, which is a rifle meant for bears with a scope, a 30-30 rifle, 12-gauge and 20-gauge shotguns, other guns also. And I had a kind of double life. I was a straight-A student by day, and at night I was wandering around our neighborhood, suburban neighborhood in California, shooting out street lamps and aiming at people through their living room windows. And I think that there are a lot of kids in suburban America who have access to guns and that this is very frightening. And so I wanted to write about that. But my editor at Esquire said, instead, why don't you write about the NIU shooting? Because this shooter was a straight-A student like you, seemed to live a kind of double life like you did, and so perhaps you would find a connection. So I said, you know, thanks for thinking of me for the mass murderer. Very nice of you. And initially the story was supposed to blend my story with his story. It ran in Esquire magazine. It was very long. It was 12,500 words, which is like a 40-page or something magazine story. And there was no room for me in it because there's just so much information about Steve. We had this mountain of facts, thousands of details that no one else had seen before except law enforcement. So my story wasn't part of it. But in the book, Last Day on Earth, I include my own story with guns, with hunting and with that double life that I led, trying to understand how it is that Steve ended up crossing the line and why I didn't, trying to not make him a monster. You know, I tried to write about Steve primarily as a suicide, not as a murderer. I think it's best to understand him as a suicide who's taking other people out with him rather than as a mass murderer.
Yeah. There, again, there's so many questions here, but just to underscore what you have said, that this grew out of this Esquire piece and that what the difference between that article, which people can still read online, and this is Last Day on Earth is a combination of journalism and memoir. So there are these two stories that you're trying to tell, that is, tell the story of Steve Kaczmierczyk, but also reflect some on your own story.
Yeah, exactly. And also in the book, Last Day on Earth, there's just a lot more about Steve, including parts that were cut out of the Esquire article. We didn't emphasize race in the Esquire article, for instance, and we had less about his sexuality and less about his mental health history, less of his emails with his girlfriends at the end that he had. So there was actually quite a bit less in the article because we had to cut it down to fit the magazine.
Sure.
It was already running very long. So in Last Day on Earth, in the book, I'm able to include all of the information, including also the aftermath, how emergency services responded, and for the victims and also the people who knew him, what it was like in the months afterwards. Not as much the victims as the people who knew him. It's really a book that focuses on the shooter and the people who are closest to him.
Yeah.
Rather than on the victim.
And as authors do, you gave talks about this book, and I know that you gave one in DeKalb, and that I think that some of the people there were mixed about the book and about your appearance.
Yeah, I was actually very afraid to appear in DeKalb to talk about it, because it's a very charged issue, and a lot of people would like the story just to go away. They'd like it to never have happened, and since it did happen, they would like it just to go away now. But it turns out there aren't many of those people. They're really mostly just in the administration at NIU. People in the town, some of them would like the story just to go away, but many would like to know the truth. They'd like to have details about it because it had a huge effect on their lives. And to not know is actually in some ways worse than knowing, because they wonder about what happened, and they can't help but think about it. It's not something you can just forget. The whole sort of rallying cry of the community of forward, together, forward, and the idea of a new normal that we'll just kind of forget what happened and move on in our new normal. That's a silly idea, of course. Whenever there's something that's big and tragic that happens, it becomes a part of your history, and it doesn't go away. Nothing makes it go away. And I think the best you can do is to talk about it and understand it. The best, of course, response would have been to try to do something about it, to try to react in some way to help prevent future shootings. And, of course, that didn't work out. Illinois tried to pass, the state legislature tried to pass a law which would have said that you can only buy one pistol per month per person. So each person can still buy 12 handguns a year. They just can't buy them all at once because the shooters go and buy a whole bunch of stuff all at once when they plan to do the shooting. And that was did not pass, and it was voted against by DeKalb's own representative, who experienced no political blowback from that. So that, to me, is incredible. It shows to me that actually the people of DeKalb did not learn from this and did not take appropriate action, did not do anything, and Americans generally have not done anything about these shootings. I had very mixed feelings about this whole book because, really, it shouldn't be written in that it doesn't matter. People who were affected by this event won't like hearing me say this, but six shootings means nothing in the United States. We have 10,000 handgun deaths a year. One weekend when I was researching the book in Chicago, there were 32 shootings with nine homicides. One of the weapons was an AK-47. That was one weekend in Chicago and isn't a story. So the big story in the U.S. is why it is that we want people to own Glock 19s, handguns that are meant to kill a lot of people very reliably without jamming. Why it is we have 10,000 handgun deaths a year and yet do nothing at all about it.
Our guest in this hour, let me reintroduce, is award-winning writer David Vann. He is the author of this book that we're talking about. The title is Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter, and it is about the shootings that took place on the campus of Northern Illinois University in DeKalb on Valentine's Day 2008. David Vann has taught at a number of places, Stanford, Cornell, Florida State. He's currently Associate Professor at University of San Francisco. He's joining us by phone. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to come back to another idea that you mentioned just very quickly, and that is that you think that we should think about Steve Kazmierczak and perhaps other people who do things like this not so much as mass murderers as people who are intent on committing suicide and taking people with them, so that there's this great destructive urge and that in part it is a self-destructive urge. But then I suppose people would look at that and say, well, if that is the case, why do these people feel compelled to commit all this collateral damage if what they're really about is harming themselves?
So I think the difference is, I think what carries someone from suicide into mass murder and suicide are a series of risk factors that help make that possible. So the most important is to be libertarian in your politics. So to be far-right conservative, all of the shooters I studied were all libertarians. And the reason they're libertarians is that political philosophy puts the individual or the small group above the rest of society. In other words, it would tear down all law and order that link us together as a society, and it puts the individual small group first. So it's the political philosophy of all the small militia groups and all the very scary right-wing contingents of our society. So that, I think, is actually the most important factor that helps someone switch from just a suicide into taking out other people with them. The next most important, I would say, would be military service. Everyone who's old enough to have served in the military who then commits some kind of mass murder has served in the military. If they're old enough, they've been in the military. And the connection there is that the military trains everyone, all of its troops, to kill without any emotional or psychological response. It trains them to kill without feeling anything. And the military dumps its members who have mental health issues, often dumps them with no warning to anyone. They began to understand that Steve was a danger to himself and others. They understood that he lied on his application, that he had this horrible mental health history, and so they dumped him in his hometown of Elk Grove Village, Illinois, and didn't notify anyone, and he didn't have any care or treatment from them. They just locked him in a padded cell and then dumped him in his hometown. We currently have 1.2 million American veterans who are seeking mental health help, and most of them aren't getting that help. There aren't mental health centers in every small town in the U.S. They're concentrated in city centers, and so many of these veterans aren't getting help. So they've been trained to kill without feeling anything. They don't have much money, have trouble getting back in society, have trouble with good jobs, family connections and such. Their political philosophy tends to be to the right. They have access to guns, and their suicides are much more likely to become mass murders as well as suicides because of these other risk factors. A mental health history also is, in a way, anyone who's suicidal has a mental health history, even if they haven't been diagnosed. But often there are other parts of that mental health history for someone who ends up becoming a shooter.
Yeah.
Then there are other things, too. Enjoying watching the Saw movies, for instance. You love those. Mm. Tattoos. I mean, you could go on forever. But those are the main factors.
I have a caller here. I want to get right to that person, I promise them. And I expect that we will hear from some people who will want to take exception, strong exception, to many of the things that you have said.
Yeah, because of course, most of America. I've actually been called the devil online. I had blogs that ended, "I reject you and cast you out."
That would not surprise me.
Un-American, told to leave the country.
Well, nice. I'm sure that people will say that there are many people who are libertarians and who are veterans and who are people who own guns who have not or never would go out and kill somebody. And I think
this is really about
the issue here is mental illness. It's not those other things.
Well, it is those other things, though. It's not just mental illness. Those are strong factors that help carry the person to make that event possible. And it's true that most of the people with those political beliefs, experiences, et cetera, don't do it, but it is those experiences and political beliefs that make it possible to do it.
All right, let's take a caller here. It's someone on a cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you're talking about political beliefs and libertarianism, because I think that the desire to be in control of your own destiny is really strong in America in terms of libertarianism. And even Noam Chomsky once called himself a libertarian socialist.
Uh-huh.
And I think those two things, wanting to take care of society and wanting to be left alone, are really strong. But my main point I wanted to give was that here at the University of Illinois, you talk about Northern learning something. And I think we go overboard in some respects of protection in terms of monitoring the way people talk and monitoring emails. And yet we do some... The university does some really are very negligent in other ways, and I have an example myself. The university has a study site out between here and St. Joe, and there's an individual that has a shooting range that he's just put up on the edge of their biological station, and it's right on the border, and they shoot right at it, and this guy uses all kinds of weapons, and we're gathering evidence for the university lawyers that it's not just him shooting, because they say that's the only way they can stop him. But you talk about Glocks and other things. I mean, this guy's got them. And it's just so obvious that you should not allow that to occur, you know, where people are working.
Right. It's true that this is the single biggest factor in our shootings is just the easy availability of guns. It is simply that. And I know there's a huge resistance to that in the U.S. We want to say that our huge proliferation of guns has nothing to do with shootings. It's just insane individuals who use guns inappropriately, but most people use the guns and they're fine. And in fact, when I was researching the story, every time I would drive to where you are, I would see signs along the highway that say guns save lives, which is the most ridiculous example of media spin I've ever seen. We have 10,000 handgun deaths a year. Our 33,000 suicides, half of those are with firearms, because, of course, we have gun deaths other than with handguns. The Supreme Court in 2008, in June, upheld the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and did so in such a way that essentially no gun control is any longer possible in the U.S. So it's not actually worth having a debate over should the Illinois legislature enact some sort of gun control, because it won't hold up. It won't hold up to a court challenge. We actually are going back to where we'll have no gun control whatsoever, which means that you can carry a gun on your hip or concealed in any environment. You'll be able to go into bars, schools, hospitals, anywhere you want. And you'll be able to do that even if you have a terrible mental health history, even if you've been in prison, even if you've been in the military. It won't matter. Everyone will be able to have these guns anywhere. That's actually the legal truth of where our country's going. And so what that means is that we're going to have more shootings of every kind, and we're going to have more suicides that are with a firearm. It's inevitable. And to me, it's crazy that we can't have the debate, that we can't agree publicly that the proliferation of these guns makes the shootings more likely. And this is because of the great power of the National Rifle Association, that they've managed to spin and shut down the conversation. They have such enormous lobbying power. To me, it's one of the most crazy things about the U.S., and especially because at the backbone of the NRA's power is this paranoid belief that the federal government wants to enslave us all, and the first step to do that is to take away our guns. And we saw when Obama was elected, for instance, there's a huge rash of buying guns because people actually believed that the federal government would now try to take away their guns. It's so crazy. I have trouble believing that it's a part of our mainstream political debate, but it is.
But one last thing. It's just the scope of the lunacy, as far as I can see, is so great, and it has so many different aspects that it's really hard to get your mind around. So I will read your book. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, thank you for the call. We'll go on to another caller here. This is Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. two things. Would your guest be kind enough to repeat? I missed part of it about his relationship with his father.
Sure. My father committed suicide when I was 13 years old, and he did it with a .44 Magnum pistol. He was in Alaska, which is a state that has the highest suicide rate for the U.S. and also the highest gun ownership rates. So it's not really an accident that's how that happened.
Okay. My second question is, have you saw or can you comment about the movie Hunger Games, which involves children and, you know, some bored teens? Have you saw that?
Yeah, and I'd actually like to comment first on We Need to Talk About Kevin, because that was a movie that came out recently also, and it's actually about a school shooting. And it's what Americans would like to believe about school shootings. The shooting happens with a bow and arrow, so it manages to completely avoid the gun issue. So it makes guns not a part of the debate at all, which is actually what Americans want. They want all of our problems with shootings to somehow be the effect of bullying or mental health issues, to have nothing to do with the fact that we have no gun control at all. The other terrible part about that movie, we need to talk about Kevin, is that the kid is born demonic from the very first. He's a little demon who hates people and is antisocial and always from the beginning. So there's nothing anyone can do, and he's going to become a shooter, and he doesn't connect to us in any way. He doesn't say anything about us, anything about Americans or America. One thing that was absolutely true in writing about this shooter is that he represented America. He had huge parts of his life connecting to tens of millions of Americans. In other words, all of his risk factors were shared by many other Americans. There are the 1.2 million American veterans with mental health issues, for instance, so he's connected to them. He liked watching the Saw movies, which connected him to tens of millions of Americans. He liked going to the shooting range, which connected him to a lot of Americans. He was in the mental health system actually has quite a few people come through it. What I would like everyone to know is that these shootings are going to go on and on and on because it's who we are as a culture. It's not one freak,
yes,
you know, one demonic person. It's actually an expression of who we are culturally, these shootings.
The Hunger Games, did you?
Oh, and sorry, and the Hunger Games, I did see those. The Hunger Games is less about mental health and these issues involved with the shooter because all of the tension comes from outside. It's an authoritarian society that makes everyone act this way and that puts pressure on them. So in that way, it doesn't actually connect to this story because what happens in these shootings in the U.S. is that there's something in the individual. Things have gone wrong in the individual that they're making the choice to do this.
Okay. And on the comment, one more comment, David.
Sure.
Yes. The thing that that I think I have discovered about our species is the conversion from maternalism, and I've said this before on this program, and I just have to repeat myself, but I think it's pertinent here, that when we decayed, when maternalism decayed away and patriotism began to accumulate and then finally to overwhelm the femme, and then they now dominate society. I mean, there are bastardized women who are portrayed in movies, books, and other media and newspapers as the counterpart of insane males, which, you know, takes me right back to the point where the system that we live in and under is all about the individual. And who is at the top of that heap? It is the, as Marx called them, the bourgeoisie. Thank you, and I'll ring off.
I don't know if you want to make your response to that or not.
Mm-hmm. I would just say that it's all men who do the shootings. That's the number one factor that unites all of them. And it's something for us to remember. I mean, if we really wanted guns to somehow be a deterrent, we have this idea that guns somehow make us safer, that if we're all armed, there'll be less shootings because we'll be able to defend ourselves. Statistically, what should happen is that we arm only women, that no men are allowed to have guns, only women can have guns. That, I think, actually would cut way down on all of our crime if we did that.
We're at our midpoint here in the conversation. We're talking with David Vann about his book, Last Day on Earth. It is about the school shootings that took place at Northern Illinois University, Valentine's Day 2008. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, why some people can't handle drinking coffee and why some babies are born with tails. Science writer Sam Keen tells the stories written by our genetic code. And we'll meet Jill Tarter. She's the scientist Jodie Foster's character in the film Contact was based on. She spent most of her career looking for signs of intelligent life in outer space. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Blood donations decrease during the summer months, but patient need remains the same year-round. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation, it's about life. More information is at 367-2202.
The guest in this hour, Focus, is David Vann. He is an internationally best-selling author. He is the author of a number of books. His first, Legend of a Suicide, has won many prizes, been translated into 18 languages. He's the author of the best-selling memoir, A Mile Down, The True Story of a Disastrous Career at Sea. And his most recent book is Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter. It's published by University of Georgia Press and is about the school shootings that took place on Valentine's Day of 2008 at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. Let's go over to Savoy for another caller here, line one. Hello.
Good morning. So far I've heard very little about the shooter. How about putting the soapbox away and getting back to the story?
Yeah, it's actually a good comment. In the book, I'm very careful not to get on a soapbox and not to present any of my political opinions. It's actually just a book which is a mountain of facts, which just sticks to the fact. And so if you read Last Day on Earth, that's what you get. Right toward the end, you have maybe two paragraphs where I give my political opinions, and that's it in the whole book. Otherwise, you get to see all of his emails at the end with his girlfriends online. You get to see his whole mental health history, his military history, his history at NIU, work history, really everything. You get to see all of the details. And so if there's a particular question you have about some aspect of his life, I'm happy to answer that. It is an entire book worth of information, and it's 1,500 pages. I think the reason that I get pulled off into, as you called it, the soapbox in radio interviews, is just because I'm so angry about the issues. I'm so angry about the fact that shooting after shooting leads to no change whatsoever, and that as Americans we have these smug beliefs that are simply untrue, like, for instance, that guns make us safer in our homes. It just enrages me, so I can't help it on the radio interviews.
Well, let me ask a different sort of question, because I don't want the entire interview to be about that, because there are some questions that are worth exploring that have to do with when a university is deciding to admit a student. What is the administration there, the people who are making the decision, what are they entitled to know about that person and their background?
This is one of the big issues to come out of these shootings, of course, is what can a university do to decrease the shootings? One important thing to know about school shootings is that usually, or often, I'm not sure exactly what the stats are, the shooter is not a student on campus at the time. In other words, schools become targets. There was a shooting in California near where I am, where a man with an AK-47 gunned down a bunch of 6 to 10-year-olds. And so the school was a kind of target. He wasn't a student there. And so nothing that the school administration could have done would have helped prevent that. At NIU, they invested a lot in the police force after this shooting, is what I've been told. And that, of course, is pointless because the shooting was planned to happen in 3 minutes. And so all they can do is respond to an aftermath, as I point out in the book. They can't actually respond to the event itself. The shooters tend to know what the procedures are in place. One solution to the problem of shootings that's been put forward by the guy who sold the guns to this shooter and also sold the guns to the VA Tech shooter is to just arm all of the students. And so he goes and visits VA Tech and NIU promoting student concealed carry of handguns on campus. So there are a lot of different approaches to how we can be safer. But the truth is that schools trying to defend themselves against this is the same as our homeland security efforts. It's enormously expensive. You have to guard everywhere at every moment, which is not actually possible to do. And so in the end, it's probably just entirely wasted money and ineffective.
Well, it may be on behalf of the last caller we had and people who are wanting to know, who still have this question about, well, who was this person? And you talked about his recreating himself, remaking himself, that made it possible for him to have a successful experience there in the couple of years before this happened at Northern. But if you go back, if you take a look at his life before college, well, what you say that there were plenty of signs that this was a very troubled individual What is it that you see?
Well, early on, his mother had him watching horror movies with her, and he had a mix of religion, which was Catholicism, and horror movies. And religion actually mixes pretty well with horror movies, in that both deny the importance of the flesh, that our bodies and our lives here aren't important, that we're actually about an afterlife, for instance. So there was some connection for him there. He was a little bit of a loner early on, just had a few kind of individual friends. They had violent things that they did early on, such as making a little Drano bomb. He slammed his dog against a wall. He had a pellet gun where he was shooting at cars. I, of course, did a lot of these things myself. I didn't watch horror movies, and I didn't slam dogs against walls, but I certainly committed petty crime and blew things up and shot things. So, again, you could say a lot of people do this. Why did it lead to his shooting? And the only answer to that, I think, is that it's a combination of everything. It's a perfect storm of all of these factors come together. So, of course, all libertarians don't become shooters, and all veterans don't become shooters. But it's when you combine everything together and you provide points of crisis that it becomes possible. So the crises that happened late in his life for him that helped push him toward the shooting were that his mother died and he had had a terrible relationship with her. He was isolated from his family and friends. He went off Prozac 2 weeks before the shooting, and when he had done that previously, it had heightened his mental health issues, and so it probably did at that time. There had been another shooting at a department store in Chicago, and usually for these shooters there is some other event that helps trigger what they're going to do. He also had moved from Northern Illinois University to University of Illinois, and so he was away from the people he knew well and his comfortable situation. So when we look for shooters, if we want to do that, we should look for people whose lives are falling apart, who are under some recent stress and have these longer-term risk factors. And then he had all of the signs that we like to think of for school shooters. He was a goth. He liked to listen to Marilyn Manson. He liked horror movies. He liked guns. He actually said things at various times that were creepy, like that he wanted to hurt people. At the end, he told his girlfriend a series of three things. If something happens to me, don't tell anyone about me. Where do you think we go after we die? Someday you can write a case study on me. So there were just really tons of warnings everywhere. But the problem is many people share these warnings. We have millions of Americans who have quite a few of these warnings. And so what's going to make one of them become the next shooter is when all of these factors come together in a way that becomes unbearable for them, where their life really collapses, and they have all these risk factors, these points of rage and training, such as military training with the guns, for instance, that enable them to extend their suicide into killing other people also.
For somebody like this, I would wonder, there might be a lot of people in a person's life like this who knew them and perhaps had one or two details that would be warning signs, the pieces of the puzzle, if you forgive the cliche, that perhaps looked at in isolation might not concern you as much as it would is if you could take all of those pieces and put them together in the way that you have. And it makes me wonder whether, in fact, there is any one person or persons who are in that position to actually see how everything fits together.
Right. At the end, his professors and other grad students at NIU did not have enough pieces of the puzzle. Hmm. Media was after them for months, hounding them for warning signs. And the truth is, they just didn't know. They didn't have any information. The reason I was able to get all this information is I was able to spend long enough time with them to realize they weren't holding out. They just didn't know anything. And so that's when I went back to junior high and high school and read all the books he'd been reading, watched the movies he'd been watching, put together a kind of profile for him for various law enforcement agencies, and shared that with them, and then they shared the files with me in return. So there were only two girlfriends he had, really one a roommate and former girlfriend, and then one a current girlfriend that he was with mostly online. who had all the information, who could have put it all together. But the problem is both of them had mental health issues. In other words, they were both a little bit crazy. And that's the problem with warning signs. What if all the people who are close enough to see all the warning signs are actually a little bit crazy themselves? They're not going to recognize anything as abnormal. Her online girlfriend has this great quote at the end where, looking back, she's thought real hard, and she just can't see anything odd about him. It's just a complete surprise. She can't see anything that was strange. And when you look at their horrific emails with each other, you think, oh, my God. I mean, they were talking about mass murder blended with racism and weird sex, like about killing black people and having sex with the mask of the Saw movies in a churchyard, and I mean, and really talking about mass murder. And to her, there were no warning signs. It was all completely fine. So as we get crazy enough, generally, it's going to be harder and harder to figure out who the likely shooters are as there become millions of us who could potentially be shooters.
Why, given that that Northern was the place where maybe he had some of the best experiences and best years of his life, was that the place that he chose to commit this violent act?
Well, the theory from his teacher, Jim Thomas, and I think Jim is right, or at least this is the best theory I've heard of why he came back, is that he wanted to destroy everything about himself. He wanted a suicide which would be complete self-erasure. So he wanted to erase everything that he had accomplished and everything that had been good about him. And so he went to the place where he had succeeded and where people loved him and admired him and where he had done well. So he went and right in front of them committed this incredibly ugly act and therefore ended up burning away and erasing everything that had been good in his life, everything that he had done. And I think that that's actually a pretty good theory. I mean, I don't have proof of it. I don't know that that's the case, of course, but that sounds about right to me. And so what it means is that a huge injustice was committed against NIU. In other words, NIU was the best part of his life. It's NIU helped reshape him and helped him to not become a shooter and almost succeeded in having him not become a shooter. So it's just so tragic and awful that they should then have to endure the shooting.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is writer David Vann. He's authored a book about the NIU school shooting, really about the person who committed it, Steve Kaczmarczyk. This was Valentine's Day 2008. His book is Last Day on Earth, and it is published by the University of Georgia Press. And, of course, questions, again, questions, comments are welcome. Someone wants to get in here real quick, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I do think that looking at family issues is important, and I think that that's consistent for a lot of shooters. He was very isolated from his family and very angry at his family. And his family had provided him some opportunities to get better. His sister, for instance, is gay, and Steve was gay also. And he told her at one point that he was gay. And I think that if he had gone down that road toward accepting his sexuality and talking about what had felt to him like a problem for a long time, and which for her was just part of who she was and not a problem, that maybe she could have helped him. But they had had such a bitter interaction over the years for so long that fell apart, and they weren't able to really have that discussion. So the failure of family ties, of that kind of reinforcement or connection, is certainly an important fact, I think, in all this, as is the going off Prozac at the end, for instance, medications and the effect of medications. I tried to understand him in the book, and I tried to keep him as close as possible and not make him a monster. But where he went off the charts for me was from the medications and the cocktails of medications in the mental health system. There are times when he just becomes not recognizable as a human to me because he's on so many drugs I can't figure out what effects are from what.
Yeah, okay. Urbana, we have a caller here, line number one. Hello.
I have a question about his father. I mean, you mentioned that he and his mom used to watch movies, and you sort of suggested that relationship might have caused some of his problems. But do you have any information about a father figure, his biological father or a stepfather or some male in his life from an early age?
Yeah, I think that there probably is something important there. His real rage was at his mother. That was the most clearly important relationship leading to this and her death at the end, and the fact that he could never go back and talk with her. He felt that she didn't accept him even after he succeeded and did well in school and everything. But with his father and other men in his family, or men maybe not in his family, he has every sign of having been sexually abused by a man early in his life, like junior high or earlier. But there's no proof of it. I can't actually find who that would have been or when it happened. It's just that he has every, in his psychological makeup and what he talks about and everything and his experiences later, it would really make sense if that had happened somewhere. Otherwise, his father is not actually that involved in the story. He's a somewhat distant figure. He was alive when the shooting happened. He died not long afterward. And he hadn't spent much effort making sense of Steve. He said he was a pretty good guy to the police. This is quote. And he was in complete denial about everything that was important about Steve's life. He said, for instance, that Steve didn't really mind the mental health system he was in Chicago, the home that he had gone to, the Mary Hill home, and Steve hated it there so much that he kept running home all the way to Elk Grove Village, and then his parents would keep returning him. So his father seemed to be distant and in complete denial about everything that was actually happening to Steve and important to Steve.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We're down to the point. We have a couple of minutes here. I'm thinking back to a conversation that I had with the author of a book about the Columbine shootings and about the fact that for several years in the process of researching the book, that the author immersed himself in the lives of the two boys that were the shooters, and that it really took a toll on him. That is, it took a toll on the writer emotionally, and I think that it was almost a kind of combat stress situation for him, that he in fact needed to get counseling himself just from the experience of trying to get into the heads of these two young men who committed the shooting.
Yeah, it's a nasty experience, and I'll never write about anything like it again. It's so dark, and I like just watching the Saw movies, which I otherwise wouldn't have watched. It gave me such a more negative view of America. I never would have said all of these things before about America before writing this. It was really a negative, awful experience. Like, really, really, I'll never do it again. And my wife was not happy about it, because for at least a year afterward, we'd be walking around, and I'd constantly mention, oh, Steve liked this, or Steve had one of these, or, yeah, Steve would say that. And so it's like Steve was a part of our lives for quite a while, because I had something like 1,200 pages of information basically memorized. I could see the pages and where the info was on the page, and I just had this mountain of facts, more facts about his life than I have about my own. I've never memorized 1,200 pages of facts about my own life all together at once. So it was very strange to kind of hold the shape of his life in my head.
So how
and,
did
and
you...
You know, I should say overall, what's most remarkable about the shape of that life and what's most remarkable to me that I was trying to capture in the book is the huge triumph of his life. I mean, that's the strange thing. He had such a miserable mental health history. I mean, it is just the worst possible thing. These cocktails of drugs, pumping up to 300 pounds, hallucinating, visions, constantly afraid. I mean, completely non-functional. And the fact that he was able to pull himself out of that and over that span of 5 years win the Dean's Award, the highest award you can win as an undergrad at NIU, I mean, it's incredibly triumphant. It's the most amazing thing I've seen. I mean, just the will he had to not become who he became in the end. That's what's tragic about his story. He wanted to not be that shooter. He did everything to try to shape his life to not become that. But he just fell apart at the end with moving school, not being in the class anymore that would matter, his mom dying, you know, all kinds of stresses. And a lot of people with mental health issues just fall apart when they're put under stress, especially if they're outside of support. He wasn't in the mental health system. He was separated from his family and friends, so he just went to the gun range. The gun range was a substitute for what should have been conversations with family, friends, and mental health practitioners.
So how then were you able to put everything that you were carrying, everything that you knew about this person, your immersion in his life and all of this darkness, how were you able to eventually just put that aside?
I haven't entirely. It's still a part of my life, unfortunately. I really wish I'd never written the story. I mean, I'd like to not have this be a part of it. I'd like to not be so angry you know, I'd like to just feel okay about America, as most Americans do. Most Americans don't think about America. They just think, eh, it's okay. And they think that libertarians just want freedom to be left alone, and fair enough. They don't realize how ugly libertarianism is, that it actually does pit the individual in society against everyone else and leads, you know, basically to the Wild West. And they don't, you know, they don't realize that what the underpinning of the NRA, the idea that the government wants to enslave us all and take away our guns, what that really means. It means the failure of our society. It means that America has failed. If we need to defend ourselves individually in our property with a gun on our hip, it means we have utterly failed. And so all those people who want those guns, they are anti-patriots. They are saying that America has failed, that America doesn't work, that we have to police ourselves.
Could it be that though, we're real quick on time here, could it be, though, that having immersed yourself in all of this, that it looms larger in your mind than it actually is in life? That is, that you see it everywhere because you've spent so much time with this.
Well, the fact is, 10,000 handgun deaths a year, 33,000 suicides, half with guns, 1.2 million American veterans needing mental health help after they've been trained to kill without feeling anything. These are just facts.
Well, there we're going to have to stop with the suggestion that if you would like to read more of David Vann's thoughts on this event and on America, you can look at the book. The title of the book is Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter, and it is about, indeed, the shootings that took place Valentine's Day 2008 at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. The book is published by the University of Georgia Press. Our guest is currently associate professor at University of San Francisco. David Vann, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, we'll talk with former New York Governor, Attorney General, and Prosecutor of Wall Street, Elliot Spitzer, about how to clean up banking. Plus, we take a disturbing look behind the record sales at Mary Kay Cosmetics. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Tonight from 9 to 11 on AM 580.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. Stuart Peterson develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information at stuart-peterson.com.
It's 10:58. I'm Craig Cohen with this commodity market update. Taking a look at the latest tick, Kansas City wheat for September is trading at 926.5. That's down 14.5. December wheat's at 942.5, down 11.5. Chicago wheat for September is trading at 923.75, down 19.5. December wheat at 931, down 17.25. Up latest tick, 930.75, down 17.5. September corn's trading at 8.15¾, down 8¾. December corn at 7.93¼, down 2¼. August soybeans at 17.23¼, down 34. September beans at 16.76, down 37¼. August soybean meal's trading at 5:30 even. That's down $13 in trading on the day. September soybean meal at 5:13.80, down $14.50. August soybean oil is trading at 53.59, down 77 cents. September soybean oil at 53.78, down 78 cents. August live cattle's at 118.25. That's up 30 cents. October live cattle at 123.37.5, up 27.5 cents. August feeder cattle's at 135.55, down 55 cents. September feeder cattle at 137.85, down 67.5 cents. August lean hogs at 93.37.5, down 32.5. And October lean hogs at 78.95, down 85 cents in trading on the day. Partly sunny skies the rest of today.